Welcome to Native America Calling. From my home studio in Isleta Pueblo, I'm Tara Gatewood. It's been nearly 5 decades since gray wolves were added to the federal endangered species list. In October of this year, the Trump administration announced it would remove the species from the list, citing adequate recovery. It's a controversial decision. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service counts at least 6,000 gray wolves in the lower United States. After the news, we'll hear about what delisting gray wolves means for tribal wildlife management. Stay with us.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Rescuers searched for 6 missing people while residents were evacuated Wednesday after a landslide in Haines, Alaska. Station KHNS reports rain triggered the large landslide and smaller ones. Relief groups and rescuers helped residents. The borough declared an emergency due to flooding, washed out roads, and damaged homes. Tribal leaders across the country are urging President-elect Joe Biden to appoint Congresswoman Deb Haaland to his cabinet as Secretary of the Interior. Some tribal leaders in Haaland's home state of New Mexico believe she's the right person for the job with a keen knowledge on Indian issues. President Gabe Aguilar of the Mescalero Apache tribe says having Haaland lead the Interior Department would be a big win.
We've worked with many people that were in that position before, you know, a lot of them been from back east. Think that maybe sometimes New Mexico, Arizona, and other tribes might be left out because they don't know too much about us. I think this would be great. I think it's one of the greatest ideas I've heard because having somebody that just has that knowledge front hand and actually a congresswoman that I imagine with all her experience she got these last 2 years to step into that position, I think it she'll hit it, knock it out the park.
Governor Brian Vio of Acoma Pueblo says Haaland's a great candidate for the position as a strong advocate for Native Americans, the LGBTQ community, and others.
She brings an incredible power and level of creative and innovative thinking and solution-driven thought process that is so important. And while I know she would do an extremely incredible job as Secretary of the Interior, you know, I also want to see her grow and continue to be the influential leader in Congress. I see Deb as Speaker of the House. I see Deborah Haaland as Vice President or even President of the United States. She's of that caliber.
Haaland's responded humbly to her name as a possible pick. Here's Haaland on the talk show Native America Calling last week.
Regardless of where I am going to make sure that this administration is successful. And I mean that with all my heart. I am honored and proud to represent the First District of New Mexico. I love my state and the people in it. And will always, whatever I'm doing, will work to that end to make sure that our state is successful.
Tribal leaders say having a Native American as Secretary of the Department of the Interior is long overdue. Haaland made history in 2018, along with Sharice Davids from Kansas, becoming the first 2 Native American women elected to Congress. The Canadian government discussed plans to improve drinking water on reserves. During a press conference Wednesday, Minister of Indigenous Services Mark Miller announced more than $1.5 billion in new investments. Miller acknowledged the government will not meet its deadline in 2021 to lift all long-term drinking water advisories.
Every boiled water advisory is unique, and we are actively exploring every possible solution in coordination with community leadership to ensure safe, clean drinking water. Our decisions must respect and listen to community needs and respond to community priorities. This work is key, and we are working quickly with communities and partners to end all long-term drinking water advisories. That is what Canadians expect from us.
The funding will go to support operations and maintenance of water systems, address water advisories, and provide technical support and training. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous population. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, joining you live from my homelands of Shirhwiptui via Skype. Wolves, once abundant in the United States, were nearly driven to extinction in the lower 48, and they were added to the federal endangered species list more than 45 years ago. Over the years, hunting and trapping restrictions and other conservation efforts by federal, state, and tribal wildlife management entities have helped stabilize wolf populations. Now, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is removing federal protections for gray wolves. Once enacted, states and tribes would have more wolf management responsibilities. Many tribes see wolves as a relative and an important part of culture and the environment. In this hour, we'll hear about how tribes plan to manage wolf populations. And you can join the conversation, too. What do wolves mean to you and your tribe? And what do you think about gray wolves being delisted? Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And joining us today from Washburn, Wisconsin, is Peter David. He is a wildlife biologist for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, a.k.a. GLIFWIC. Our pleasure to have him here. Peter, thank you for joining us for another Native America Calling.
It's you, Tara. It's a pleasure to be here, and I hope you and all your listeners are doing well in these challenging times.
Great to have you here. Also, out of Browning, Montana, is Gerald Buzz Cobell. He is the director of the Blackfeet and Wildlife Department, and Blackfeet Fish and Wildlife Department, and he is Blackfeet. Our pleasure to have him here. Buzz, welcome to Native America Calling.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here as well, and look forward to visiting with you about wolves.
Indeed. And so, gentlemen, just to kind of set some things, just trying to understand about what this delisting means, Peter, any thoughts about how this will change the way things are being currently managed in the areas that you connect to?
Well, it'll have a huge impact here in the Midwest because in this area, delisting is sort of synonymous almost with the implementation of hunting and trapping seasons. We did have a period here, you know, back in 2012, 2014 when wolves were delisted. And both Wisconsin and Minnesota had fairly aggressive harvest seasons, recreational seasons that our member tribes have been very much opposed to. So that's one of the biggest differences that'll be taking place.
And for you, Buzz, what are some of the things you immediately see changing?
I don't really see the Blackfeet changing much. We've been managing wolves under a wolf management plan we put into place back in 2008. And I think for the most part, wolves are doing very well and on the reservation, and we've been handling any wolf problems as they come up, but as long as they're, you know, living their lives, feeding off of big game and so forth, they really don't cause much of a problem, and they seem to be doing well.
And when it comes to understanding this, you do have to understand each place is different. Is that something that you subscribe to, Peter?
Well, I think that's very true. You know, that was one of the issues, I guess, with people who had a concern about this delisting, is that it based really on the health of the population in a few small locations like the Midwest, a very large landscape, you know, from coast to coast and from the Dakota to Texas was delisted from wolves. Some of those areas, I think you could argue, wolves had recovered significantly, but there's also great tracts out there where wolves haven't recovered at all. And so it's a very different landscape, and wolves themselves are different, I think, in different regions.
And so when you consider your region, tell us a little bit about, you know, how they connect to the land. I understand they're territorial. Give us some 101 on wolves. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, you know, and I'll say we were lucky. It was northern Minnesota was the last place in the lower 48 where wolves had managed to hang on. I'm in northern Wisconsin. I'm from this area, but I was born into a state that was wolfless. But we've seen really tremendous wolf recovery in this region with the help of the Endangered Species Act. And so now, between the three states here, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, you know, there's about 4,400 wolves in this region, and that really is a pretty amazing thing. And it's incredibly important to our member tribes, you know, to the relationships, the cultural relationships that the Ojibwe have with Mayangan. I really can't be overstated. But, you know, wolves, you know, for, as basic background, you know, this is a very social species. That's one thing that really makes them unique, you know, living in a pack structure. And that pack is really an extended generational thing. So primarily you'd have a alpha pair, it's often called, you know, a single breeding pair in that pack. Their pups perhaps from a year ago, and then the pups maybe from the current year. That's sort of an average situation, but there's a great deal of variability around that. And as pups reach about 2 years of age, they will tend to move out and strike out on their own and try to find new habitat. But the other thing about wolves that's really important biologically is that they are territorial, as you mentioned. And that means that wolves will very actively defend their territories against other wolves, and that becomes a very limiting thing in terms of their population numbers. So we've seen, for example, the population in Minnesota now has stopped growing. The Upper Peninsula of Michigan has stopped growing, and Wisconsin's population is probably very close to its natural carrying capacity on the landscape right now. And that's a big thing because people see these populations increasing and concerned about them, but we know biologically that they're going to taper off here, even at very low numbers.
And so for you, Buzz, how does that compare, the way, you know, how they move and how they thrive? Give us a picture of what you see in your area.
Well, back in the 80s, we started seeing wolves coming back onto the reservation. We figured they came down from Canada and they established a pack on our reservation in about 85, 86 in that time period. And because one of the things that's kind of interesting to note is that tribal lands kind of across the United States contain a lot of good habitat. And because the Blackfeet Reservation has pristine wildlife habitat, we're tucked in right adjacent to Glacier National Park, and we're bordered on the north by Canada. We have a lot of wildlife species here. And so the wolves came down on their own, and they like Peter pointed out, they expand, you know. They break off from a main pack, and then they establish another pack. And so on our reservation, we probably have four or five active packs right now. And So I think we, as a people, have always lived in harmony with wolves. And, you know, some of our family names on the reservation are Running Wolf and Spotted Wolf and names like that. And it's because, you know, our people have always had a great deal of respect for wolves and how they live in a family pack. They're good hunters. They're very smart, and So because of those kind of attributes, you know, they're highly respected and revered in the Blackfeet culture. And here on the reservation, they're doing well. The only time we really have to step in and do any management is when they kill livestock. And this last year, I think we had 4 instances where we had to remove some wolves because they were killing cattle. I had, I think, 3 cows that were killed and 1 horse.
And so what's the take from ranchers and farmers there on the tribe? Is it, you know, once one is in the area, once one takes one of the cattle, they've got to go? Tell me a little bit about that, Buzz.
I think our reservation has a lot of cattle ranchers. And over the years, we've kind of established that as kind of a main industry for our people. And so we do have a lot of livestock owners that are on the reservation. Some are tribal members, some are not tribal members. And whenever they do have grizzly bears or wolves or mountain lions take an animal, they want to address that. They want somebody to do something about that. We have a MOU that we just signed last year with the USDA Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, Wildlife Services Agency. And so we have a tribal member that named Glenn Hall that goes out and investigates any suspected depredations by wolves, grizzly bears, or mountain lions. And so he'll go out there and check, and if it's actually been a wolf kill or whatever, then he'll give me a call, and we'll give them the okay to go out and try to locate the wolves. And as Peter probably attests, these wolves are very, you know, smart, and they're very difficult to hunt.
Sure, and there's a lot in consideration, and I really appreciate the both of you giving us an insight into this. And there's more to understand also with the delisting. There are people with different thoughts. Give us a call. Join us if you'd like to. 1-800-99-NATIVE.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says face masks are effective for reducing the spread of the coronavirus. But government mandates to wear masks are getting pushback by some who see them as an infringement on personal liberties. We'll get the latest on the benefits and drawbacks of masks on the next Native America Calling.
Support for this program is provided by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles the issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. What AARP does might surprise people. For more information and resources, including member benefits, AARP advocacy, and more, go to aarp.org.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Masada Pueblo, and we are talking about gray wolves being taken off the endangered species list. If you live in wolf territory, what do you think about this change? Join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And with us today on the line is Gerald Buzz Cobell. He's the director of the Blackfeet Fish and Wildlife Department, and he is Blackfeet. Also here, too, is Peter David, who is a wildlife biologist for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here. And Gerald, something that you brought up before the break was cultural connections to wolves and tribes there. Tell me a little bit about some of those cultural connections. How big of a role do they play in culture?
Well, I think the fact that our people have initiated a wolf management plan on their own, and the effect of this delisting really doesn't mean a lot to us here on the ground. As Blackfeet people, we have a deep respect for all the wildlife that are on our reservation. We've always lived in this area for thousands of years, and so we've lived in harmony with wolves, grizzly bears, and the other four-leggeds out there. And so for us, they'll always be important to us. So I think the only time that we really have issues is when you know, we have conflicts with livestock owners and that sort of thing. But for the most part, these wolves have been able to be here, like you said. They came back onto the reservation in the mid-'80s, and here we are in 2020, and we don't have, you know, tons of problems with them. They seem to be able to, you know, expand their territories, and they're moving elsewhere in Canada and in other parts of Montana. And so I feel like the tribe as a people, we have a very, you know, close connection to the landscape, and we just like to see them out there. I'm sure there's probably some of our native dancers you'll see out during our ceremonies and powwows that might have a wolf pelt as part of their costume. And it's, again, you know, we know that animal is beautiful. We appreciate the attributes that it has as far as being a family kind of oriented animal, and that they're good hunters. They're very social, and so we have a great deal of respect for them. And so because of that, they'll always be part of the Blackfeet Reservation, and our people don't need to be told to protect them. We will protect them.
Thank you for that, Buzz. And what about your own tribal community? What are the connection to wolves? And if you also play a part in wildlife management, have a thought, give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. And Peter, remind us of the communities that you are working with there with Glyphwick. And I'm also curious, too, about cultural connections and beliefs connected to wolves.
Well, yeah, you mentioned wolves being relatives to many Native Americans, and that's certainly true for the Ojibwe. And it goes back to the Ojibwe origin story. And in that telling, that the original man really was lonely of spirit. And when he spoke to the Creator about that, the Creator responded by bringing down the wolf to be the companion, the first companion to walk and to talk and to play with. And although the Creator later intervened again and separated man and wolf, but indicated that both of them were going to be on sort of a parallel course and would have intertwined fates. And you can find all sorts of examples of that over history, where really the wolves and Native American people have been treated very similarly. And I think even contemporarily you can see examples of that here in Wisconsin. It was really interesting to me to watch that the reaffirmation of the tribe's off-reservation treaty rights and the recovery of wolves in the state really were taking place in sort of lockstep time. And a lot of people responded to those things very similarly. Some people saw both of those things as recovery, but there was also large components of the non-tribal community that was threatened by both of those. You know, they pointed the finger at wolves and said that, you know, these are going to be damaging, they're going to wipe out the deer herd and have all these native impacts. And the Ojibwe tribes practicing their treaty rights were going to have those kinds of impacts as well. Of course, that didn't come to pass. But I think the bottom line is that when you have that kind of brother relationship with Mayingan, then our communities want really for wolves the same thing they want for their own communities.
And so remind me of the tribes that you're working with.
There's a Glyphwick is a coalition of tribes, all Ojibwe, all that were co-signatory to particular treaties. But we have 6 tribes in Wisconsin, 2 tribes in Minnesota, and 3 tribes in Michigan. So we cover, from the off-reservation ceded territory perspective, about the northern third of Wisconsin, the western half of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and a portion of what is now east central Minnesota. And so our perspective tends to be a little bit different. Each of our member tribes is managing wolves on the reservation within their boundaries, and part of Glyphwood's role is try to sort of coordinate tribal interests and implementation of the treaty rights in this larger off-reservation landscape.
And so when you say managing, what changes now that they're being delisted? Do some of those management procedures, are they changing? What is the buzz among tribes there in your network?
Yeah, you know, first of all, just a comment on that term, and I'll flip back and forth, but tribes more and more have been moving away from using the word management even, since that doesn't really reflect the kind of relationship that you have with your relative. You don't want to manage your relative. So sometimes it's stewardship is used, and sometimes we just talk about the relationship that exists between people and this more than human being. And so, again, our tribes are very protective of wolves. Every tribe that I know of in this region that has a management plan, the reservations are essentially wolf sanctuaries. But our reservations tend to be small in this area, and there's probably no such thing as an on-reservation wolves. The territories are big enough that these wolves will spend time both on and off the reservation. And that didn't matter a lot when wolves were under the Endangered Species Act and weren't harvested. But now there'll be a very big concern as hunting and trapping seasons start taking place just offside the reservation. And the tribes are going to be, you know, really interested in trying to protect those wolves that are in those boundary areas and really throughout the whole ceded territory.
And so with some of these changes coming about, you know, what are some of the things that, you know, just even ranchers, citizens, and hunters, is there anything they need to know? Peter?
Yeah. You know, one thing I would say, I think one of the really big roles the tribes have had is to help educate the general public about wolves as they really are. I think Europeans came and sort of made wolves into what they wanted them to be and vilified them in many ways. And I think Native Americans had a much truer understanding of what wolves really are and how to interact with them, how to coexist with them. And I think the things Buzz is saying, you know, that it's not that hard. These are not impossible things, and yet in the non-tribal communities, those are sometimes brought up as big challenges. Livestock depredation certainly happened here, too, not on the reservation so much, but in the ceded territory, certainly. But on the scale of things, they're really quite small. The number of wolves, for example, that are killed or maimed by wolves in Wisconsin in a typical year is comparable to the number that go to slaughter every 30 minutes. So it can be a big issue if you are an individual livestock raiser who's lost animals, but from an industry level, it's not, you know, insurmountable by any means. So those are the things, though, I think that the tribes can help educate and teach about just how to coexist and how to have the proper kind of relationship with Mayangan.
Certainly. And Buzz, anything to add?
I would say that the main idea that probably I'd say you need to come away with from the Blackfeet perspective is just that, you know, wolves are our brother. They've been out there, and we lived in harmony with them back before the white man came and before they were exterminated. And now that they're coming back, they're kind of finding their niche. They find a good habitat. We find the wolves kind of where our big game populations reside, and they've kind of carved out an area, and that's where they live. And for the most part, they don't cause a lot of problems for us. But when they do, you know, we deal with it, and it seems like our tribal membership, you know, they only call us when there's a problem. Otherwise, you know, they feel like they're out there just part of the landscape like they've always been.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're looking for
different perspectives. You're hearing two of them here on this program today. We're also looking for yours too. Join us at 1-800-996-2848 is a number. Anything you want to pick up on, call in 1-800-996-2848. How do populations look in your area? Have they affected your community? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. Let's take a call. We have Michael in Jemez Pueblo today, tuned in on KUNM. Michael, thanks for reaching out. You're on air.
Yeah, thanks a lot for taking my call. Yeah, in New Mexico, we have the Mexican gray wolf. It's also called the lobo. It's a smaller version of the northern wolf packs. And they've had contentions with the ranchers down south in southern New Mexico where they're introduced. And also it said that all dogs are descendants of the wolves. And I was wondering what the people on your show think of hybrids and them being let go into areas. You know, you hear about that a lot. So I was wondering if they've interacted with hybrid populations.
All right, Michael, thank you for your call here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can call in too. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Peter, I'll turn to you. And I'm also curious on this too. We were at a relative's house and saw something, and then some people said it was a wolf, some people said it was a dog, and maybe this is one of the hybrids that Michael is talking about. Tell me a little bit more, Peter.
Well, I guess I'd give you my personal opinions on that. First of all, I think certainly it's true, dogs are descendants of wolves. That being said, I am generally leery of the idea, or not very supportive of having animals that are really sort of hybrids today between wolves and dogs. I think they can be unpredictable animals, and you don't necessarily get the best of both worlds in that case, and that those gene pools are probably in the long run better kept separately. In one of the good things about really having healthy wolf populations is that I think hybrids occurring in nature are actually very unlikely to happen under that scenario. Perhaps sometimes when wolf populations are very distressed and wolves aren't able to find other wolves to mate with, there might be some greater likelihood of interbreeding taking place. But, you know, generally from a biological perspective, we would like to see wolves stay wolves.
And so to settle the debate between my family, how do you know when it's a wolf and not a dog?
You know, it's not very easy oftentimes on a landscape or from a coyote, you know, and even though those animals are fairly different each other in terms of, you know, their height and their weight and all of those kinds of things, when you see an animal on the landscape from a distance and you don't have good reference points, it's not as easy as you would think. If you get, you know, really close, there are differences you can often tell. And between dogs and wolves, you know, tracks are helpful, although there can be a great overlap in track size between those two. But wolves, for example, will tend to walk in more of a linear fashion. The foot drops will be one in front of the other, whereas dogs tend to be broader chested, and so their foot patterns will be a little spread apart, and they'll tend to wander more, not walk as directly. So if you can find those kinds of cues, and between wolves and coyotes, you can look for things like the length of the legs and the shape of the ears and the how broad the snout is to make some differentiations. But, you know, it's not that often that you get long, lingering looks at these animals, and it can be a challenge, you know, at times. And that's, you know, even when wolves have been protected, there's always been a number of them accidentally shot by people who thought they were looking at coyotes.
And so I guess that begs the question, if you run into a wolf, what should you do?
I would enjoy the experience. You know, although wolves are often made out to be very dangerous animals, you know, there's so few instances of wolves attacking people that it's you know, you're at a much greater risk at 100 other things every day. I do sometimes run into people here who say, you know, I'm afraid to drive out to the National Forest and take a hike because of wolves. I tell them that it's the drive that's the dangerous part of that experience. You know, wolves are generally shy. They will generally disappear if they see you and are aware of you. Certainly respect this animal. And the few times where negative things have happened, it's often been when wolves have been sort of habituated to people in bad situations around dumps or food giving and that kind of thing. That's not a good way to interact. But if you respect the animal and show it some distance, you can just simply enjoy being near wolves.
So this is yet another animal not to go and try and take a selfie with.
Exactly. Exactly. And don't walk up to it with a hot dog in your hand, you know. But if you maintain some distance, to hear a wolf howl or to see a wolf on the landscape is a pretty incredible experience.
All right. Thank you for that. And there is more wolf talk ahead. And we're ready for you to talk with us, too. Anything you want to share in this conversation, connections to wolves, and even cultural sides to this. Maybe there is a story that you are able to share now that the snow is on the ground that you just want to add to this conversation. Our phone lines are open to you, too. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And if you have questions, call in, too. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And I'm also looking for thoughts on the delisting of gray wolves. Where do you stand on it? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We look forward to anything you'd like to contribute to our conversation today. Maybe you're from one of these communities that we are talking about today. Give us a view from the ground. What are you seeing? Any changes? How has the environment evolved because of the wolves being there? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848.
If you're hurting in your relationship and want to talk, Strongheart's Native Helpline is a confidential and anonymous domestic violence helpline for Native Americans available at 1-844-762-8483 or connect with a live advocate by using the Chat Now button at strongheartshelpline.org. Advocates offer support and referrals for resources daily, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Central Time. This program supported by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
Thanks for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, and we are focusing on gray wolves today. After more than 45 years, they're being taken off the endangered species list. How significant are wolves to your Native culture? Join our conversation at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And here with us on the line today is Peter David and Gerald Buzz Cobell. If you have any thoughts for either of them, call in now, 1-800-996-2848. And Peter, in terms of delisting gray wolves, any understanding of how we got to this point? Was there a large lobbying effort to get this changed? Any thoughts on the background of how we got to this point?
Well, that's a complicated question. Certainly, you know, the goal generally of having an endangered animal is to get it healthy enough to get it off the list. But there have been some strong political pressures, I think, to go around the Endangered Species Act at time. In fact, in Buzz's part of the world, that region was previously delisted really through an act of legislation, not through a formal delisting action. And there's been a lot of political pressure in this region to get wolves off the endangered species list because states and some livestock interests and other sporting groups, sometimes sportsmen who are interested in big game animals, feel that we have a quote-unquote wolf problem. You know, the numbers are too high and that the state isn't able to control or manage wolves in the way that they think is necessary. And so there is certainly political pressure going on, and it's hard to know how much of that folds into it. There was maybe curious the timing of the announcement of this delisting right in the election campaign. But the big question, I think, from a biological question, is have wolves really recovered on the landscape or not? And what part of their historic range should be recovered to really be considered fully recovered? When this delisting proposal went out, I think it generated more comments on the Federal Register than any other issue that they had ever posted. So people really feel strongly about wolves, both positively and negatively.
Thanks for that. And you know what? I got a caller. Let's take her. We have Marina in Cheyenne River, South Dakota, tuned in on KLND. Marina, thanks for reaching out. You're on air.
Oh, hello. I am Tashunka Washdewi Hamachepi, Good Horsewoman. And I am very honored to speak on these federal, like, animals. Or, you know, they are like my mom. She walked for the buffalo. And with the positive side, these reflects for our people. And cultural-wise, it also reflects for our people. These wolves are medicine, and they, you know, should have some positive effects on our people. And just like the dying buffalo and so forth, you know, with our sacred animals and what our beliefs are. And so, you know, with the positive effects that, you know, maybe it'll bring back some, you know, nurturing, like some plantations, some, you know, connection with our, you know, equality of this environment, you know, and we need to bring, you know, part justice for them because, you know, they are part of our ancestral roots and our ancestral animals.
And, you know, Marina, just hearing your connections to it and the diversity of how people feel about this, it's really great to have this community conversation about all of this. And we appreciate your call there out of Cheyenne River, South Dakota. Buzz is on the line, too. And, Buzz, is there anything you want to add?
Well, like Peter pointed out, wolf recovery differs across the landscape. And in the Great Lakes, what problems they face out there is quite different than what we have up here in north central Montana. But I think one kind of underlying challenge for wolves is the fact that they do kind of compete with hunters for big game. And I know in Montana and other western states, there's quite a bit of backlash against wolves and wolf recovery because they do take big game animals. You know, they're out there and they're going to take elk and moose, and that's how they've survived all these many years. And so it's hard for us as human beings, I guess, to share that resource and let them be back on the landscape like they used to live. Back in the day when buffalo were plentiful on the plains, the Blackfeet and other Plains Indians had plenty of food, and there was enough to go around, and wolves and grizzly bears and other critters were out there, and there wasn't any real competition. But now there's just islands of habitat around the country, and a like the Blackfeet, we have high-quality wildlife habitat. Of course, the wolves come here, and they're doing fine. But even here on Blackfeet, I'm sure that I'm going to have challenges down the road because I have some of the hunters telling me that, you know, there's a pack of 20 wolves in the Boulder Mountain area of our reservation, and they're basically, you know, having an impact on our elk and moose recruitment. So I'm sure down the road it's something that we're going to have to try to balance as far as wolf numbers and what effect they're going to have on our big game populations. And so to try to get ahead of the curve, I've been in communication with John Waller, a carnivore biologist with Glacier National Park, and we're working together with Wildlife Services to try to put together a research study to get a better handle on wolf numbers and what effect they are having on big game populations in this area.
Yeah, that would be interesting information to take a look at. Thanks for that, Buzz. I got another caller on the line. We're going to go to Molly in, oh, we lost Molly. If you'd like to join us, 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And Buzz, just wanted to get your take too, and just putting the pieces together of the delisting. Do you know any information on how we got to this point?
Well, I think there's a lot of pressure. Again, I think it's coming from the hunting community and the livestock industry that, you know, our wolf populations in this part of the world are, you know, healthy enough where they're starting to have impacts upon the numbers of big game out there. Say if you take elk, for instance, I think, you know, there's studies down in the Yellowstone area where they're able to show that, you know, wolves are having an effect on elk populations. And so hunters are wanting to, you know, open up seasons on wolves and be able to have some kind of a dampening effect on the wolf's effect on big game availability. And then I think livestock owners, even here on the reservation, we have, you know, Blackfeet tribal members who want wolves to be hunted more and to kind of reduce the likelihood of them losing livestock to wolves. So I think it's a challenge that's going to be there, and it's because of lack of habitat, you know. If you look at the Blackfeet Reservation, where we're located, we're on the west or on the east side of Glacier National Park, which once was our land that we had given up back in 1895, 96. We're on the east side of Glacier National Park, and we're relatively undeveloped over here, so wolves and grizzly bears and wildlife are doing well over here. But if you go on the west side of Glacier National Park, there's all kinds of development occurring, and so that habitat's shrinking for these critters, and that's happening all across America. And so it just creates these islands of habitat, and a lot of it's tribal land because tribal members and tribal governments aren't normally, you know, developing their land at a fast pace. We're more, slow when it comes to doing that kind of development, and that's been to the benefit of our people and also to the benefit of wildlife species like wolves. But across Montana, I think there is quite a bit of pushback in states like Montana and Wyoming, Idaho, where hunters realize that the more wolves that there is on the landscape, the less maybe elk there is for them to harvest. And then you have the livestock industry who have, you know, concerns about wolves depredating upon their livestock. So I think that's probably some of the biggest challenges is that. And then just the reality of there isn't that much great wolf habitat out there anymore.
And just hearing all of those different things, I'm learning a lot today, and I appreciate both you, Buzz, and Peter, for giving us information. And maybe you, too, are learning a lot, and you have some comments. You can always reach out, 1-800-99-NATIVE, and you can do that is our Twitter handle, too, if you want to send us a tweet. Let's try Molly again, joining us today out of Lower Kalskag, Alaska, tuned in on KYUK. Molly, thanks for reaching out. You're on air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to add to when growing up, I learned
I bet she was about to tell us something really good. Molly, sorry, we got a bad connection. And Buzz, I wanted to turn back to you. I know that we're talking about delisting through federal measures, but there's also states who are involved in all this. And before it was, you know, dealing with the state too. Anything you want to share about state relations and tribes and, you know, wolves in the area and what people are doing, what they can and can't do? Is that some space that we need to explore too, or give some recognition to, because this delisting might be changing things? I don't know. You tell me, Buzz.
As far as state tribal relations, I guess. Over the years, there's kind of been a love-hate relationship there. I think of late, you know, states are more willing to work with tribes on wildlife-related issues. But, you know, in the early 80s, there was a lot of Supreme Court cases that came down where states were trying to manage wildlife on tribal lands. And there was a big case in the Mescalero and with the White Mountain Apache tribes in the Southwest where they basically went to court. And it was established that we as Indian people are in charge of our own destiny when it comes to management of our resources, including wildlife, on Indian lands. And so over time, that's kind of been well established. But we do look to the state and work with them on, you know, collaborative projects to try to better manage wildlife, because the big game and the wolves and the grizzly bears, they don't know where the boundary of the reservation and the boundary of the national park or national forest ends. They just go where the habitat is. And over time, I think it's going to take a little more collaboration amongst the state, federal, and tribal entities to better manage resources like wolves and bears and big game, because they need, you know, quite a bit of habitat, so they're not always living on one particular jurisdiction their whole life. They spend part of their life, say, in Glacier National Park in summer and spring, and then in the fall and winter, they're on the Blackfeet Reservation. And so it takes some coordination amongst the various agencies. And I think what's difficult for the general public to understand is, you know, if you live in San Francisco, California, whatever, and you just want, you know, to support the idea of wolf recovery, is they don't really understand the importance of habitat, having good quality habitat for those critters to exist on, and that the fact that they're competing with, you know, man, and their use of that landscape. And so the conflicts between hunters, ranchers, and wolves isn't going to go away. It needs to really be a well-coordinated effort, thinking that, hey, this four-legged brother of ours deserves his place on the landscape. How do we make that happen?
Yes, definitely things to consider. And if we have any hunters or ranchers out there who have a take on all this, we hope you'll reach out. You can always find us comments at nativeamericacalling.com. And Peter, I'll go to you to wrap it up. We have less than a minute. Anything to leave us with?
Well, I would say quickly on this hunting issue, what we have found in this part of the world is that we really look to wolves to help actually with deer herd health. We have a big issue with chronic wasting disease in deer, and we think wolves can have a very important role actually in pruning the herd. And the caller who mentioned wolves as medicine, I also wanted to touch on, you know, we know wolves have big impacts on the forest construction, the plants that are there, and many of those plants that tribal members use for medicines are better protected when we have wolves on the landscape. So we're welcoming them back here, and are glad that the brother has returned to these ceded lands.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up today. Thank you both to Gerald Buzz Cobell and Peter David for joining us today. Tomorrow, we hope you'll join us for a discussion about masks, safely wearing them, and their role in the coronavirus. Thanks for joining us today. And if there's anything more you'd like to share, visit us online, nativeamericacalling.com. And you can even leave show suggestions by sending us an email. There is something that you'd like us to look into, important people in your community to feature. Tell us about it. Again, that email, comments@nativeamericacalling.com. I'm Tara Gatewood. We'll meet you here tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in today. We look forward to adding you to our conversation tomorrow or sometime in the future.
O siau, na hiu a lihelu sti da skolaha, ge hi a tada na iji si da nela yusti una danilo his tana, julo sa'i. Yitzate no yusti una danilo his tana, yo stela digu tani das doti o wasa a dalsi doti. Tatlano heta ni euia a yela nu danadega an accestis naski yiged stela. At healthcare.gov, ale 1-800-318-2596. Hi a ge tano sa Medicare ale Medicaid una dalga'i.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Amerind works with tribal governments and their business enterprises to provide effective commercial insurance coverage, strengthen Native American communities, protect tribal sovereignty, and help keep dollars in Indian Country. More information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto solutions at Amerind.com. That's AMERIND.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.